From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're looking for a metaphor for today's discussion, think of the movies. The columnist E.J. Dionne is our guest, and he's written a book that explores the two traits that make us American. There's the rugged individualist, think High Noon. But there's also the devotion to community, think It's a Wonderful Life. Dionne says we're a nation of both movies, that when we've gotten it right as a country, we live within the tension of those two impulses, and we balance them out. Dionne says his book is an effort to make sense of our current political unhappiness, is how he puts it. So he delves into the country's history to explain why the divisions in our politics run so deep, and what he's found may help explain why we're arguing so much. The book is called Our Divided Political Heart, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the writer and scholar E.J. Dionne writes about the two traits that describe the American character, the sense of individualism and the sense of the larger community. Dionne argues that at our best moments, we found a balance between the two. In the book, he invokes a device Bill Clinton used from time to time, a common penny. The former president would point out the single word liberty on one side of the coin. On the other was our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. That humble penny, Clinton used to say, is an explicit declaration that you carry around in your pocket, that America is about both individual liberty and community obligation. But E.J. Dionne says at some point over the last decade or so, that balance has been thrown off kilter. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about the book, his effort to explain what he describes as our current political unhappiness. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. And E.J. Dionne is a columnist for The Washington Post. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. It's a public policy think tank. He's also a professor at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute at Georgetown, and the author of a number of books. We'll mention some of those a little bit later on the program. He's joining us today from a studio at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. E.J. Dionne, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And that was one of the loveliest introductions I've gotten on the book. I love the fact that you referred to High Noon and It's a Wonderful Life. Thank you.
Good. Well, I want to start with what I guess is kind of the central, or a central myth anyway, that you're trying to kind of make sense of. And that is this idea, as you put it in the book, that there is just one single trait that explains our success as a country, this powerful sense of individualism. How is it that you figure we've sort of gotten that sense? And is it kind of the central myth that you're working on?
Right. No, that's a good way to put it. And it became central because there is truth to it. And I think one of the important things that I'd like to underscore is when the title of the book, Our Divided Political Heart, comes from the idea that from the very beginning, pardon me, we've been torn by our devotion, between our devotion to individualism and liberty and our affection for and quest for community, and our awareness that you cannot defend, you can't defend your own liberty if we don't come to the defense of each other's liberty. But I am certainly not denying the importance of liberty in the American idea or to the American people. Liberty is a very important part of us. But I think not only with our friends in the Tea Party, but also in some of the academic work on the American idea, the idea of liberty and certain older forms of liberalism, which were really not exactly like today's liberalism that emphasized individual rights, really were seen as the one dominant American idea and everything else was secondary. Whereas I think that if you look at the strands that you mentioned earlier, that there were important communitarian strands from our belief in a small R Republican tradition, which emphasized the self-government and our obligation to the common good, and our biblical tradition, those went alongside a very strong individualistic strains that came came from some ways from Ben Franklin and other ways from Walt Whitman. Mm. These have been part of us all the way through. I love to point out that the first word of the American Constitution is not the word I, it's the word we, as in we the people of the United States. And as a friend pointed out to me, it's not we the persons of the United States, it's we the people. It's all of us together. And it sets out a series of common goals for our Constitution. We, I don't think, focus enough on the fact that we is right there at the beginning of our most important governing document.
I'm wondering how you're thinking evolved as you were writing the book, or what surprised you, I guess. And I'm wondering if you understood, or if you were at all surprised by kind of what seems to be a kind of counterintuitive sense that, for example, on one hand, there was such a strain of individualism in early liberalism, and such a strain of communitarianism in the early conservative movements. It seems counterintuitive almost.
Well, that's true because liberalism was transformed both here and in the United Kingdom, in particular in Britain, by people who were influenced by populist, progressive, socialist, social democrats, all of whom saw that if you really cared about individual autonomy as well as individual liberty, you needed some social protections for individuals. People needed the capacity through public schooling, for example, or through an ability to organize at their workplace. They needed the capacity to exercise their freedom. So that's a way in which liberalism changed. Conservatives were always communitarian. Indeed, as I point out in the book, in some ways, conservatism arose in reaction to liberal individualism. Yeah. Conservatives placed a heavy emphasis on locality, hierarchy, the ways in which we were knitted together. And so the current form that conservatism has taken, which I argue really worships almost a kind of radical individualism, is quite distant from the tradition. One of the fun discoveries of the book is I spent a lot of time with the American Whigs, whom I came to be. I've always been fascinated by the Whigs, but all the more so from writing about this book. And for those of your listeners who listen to David Brooks and me argue about politics on NPR, I told David early on, actually when I finished the book, I said one of the great things about writing it was I finally discovered why you are crosswise to current American politics, and it's because you are the last surviving American Whig. And if you think about David's form of conservatism, which is really different from a lot of forms out there now, it's because he's really a Henry Clay Abe Lincoln guy still. And that's an old tradition in the Republican Party that, again, I think they have largely jettisoned.
Mm. I want to work through the Henry Clay idea as we go. But you say right up front, I want to get this out of the way, that when you're talking about the tension between individualism and community, that you don't think government is the same thing as community.
Right. I think it's and I think those of us who are progressives, and I'm a progressive, I the title for myself I like best actually came from a conservative publication, National Review. They once called me a communitarian liberal, and that's kind of how I think of myself. But I think that we do sometimes conflate the state with the community. And obviously, there are all kinds of forms of local community that are independent of the state, whether you're talking about churches or synagogues or mosques or little leagues or rotary clubs. These are, and we could multiply that list. These are independent organizations that are communitarian. And lots of conservatives, by the way, belong to organizations like that. But if the liberal error is to conflate the two too much, I think the conservative error is to insist that government is always completely independent of the community. Whereas my argument with conservatives is that in a free and democratic republic, the government is often called upon by the people to serve the community interests. Not only that, government can actually strengthen community even all the way down to the local level. One of my favorite government programs is the AmeriCorps program, which gives all lots of Americans, particularly but not exclusively young people, a chance to serve the country for a year or two. And a lot of the AmeriCorps volunteers are financed to work in very local organizations, including religious institutions. And that's a clear case where very modest amounts of government money actually help strengthen some of our most local forms of community. So I think it's important for liberals to remember the distinction between government and community. I think it's important for conservatives not to drive a very hard wedge between government and community.
You write about in the book how we use history, and you talk about how politicians and political movements over time try to kind of establish these connections to the past. You say that we Americans have this habit of searching for precedent, looking for heroes. The Tea Party, for example, which you write about, is just, I guess, the latest incarnation of that, just trying to sort of look back to the past to find some precedent for our thinking today, I guess.
Well, one of the great things about America, about the United States, is that we're not a blood and soil kind of nation. We do not define our peoplehood, if you will, by who our ancestors were, because all of us come from all over the world. And so that makes us, in a different sense than the term is usually used, a people of the book and a people of ideas and a people of history, that what we share in common whenever we came here is participation in this long American story. It's one reason why I think we draw on history so much to justify whatever we might be doing at a given time. It's why the Constitution is so important to us and why it has an almost quasi-religious meaning in our polity. I specifically criticize treating the Constitution as if it came down to us on tablets from heaven, because I think we've got to remember the founders were politicians. They were people who were making compromises. It doesn't mean that we don't honor them, and it certainly doesn't mean that they weren't gifted. But I think that because we are a people more of an idea and a history than we are of blood and soil, these things matter a great deal to us. And so politicians all the time look back to the past. An example I use in the book is how both Franklin Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt's critics invoke Thomas Jefferson when talking about the New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt talked about Jefferson, the great small d Democrat, who wanted a degree of equality among Americans and who revered the common people and thought we were there. All people in America were uncommon people. We shouldn't have sharp class boundaries. The conservatives criticized the New Deal, also invoking Jefferson by saying that FDR was being inconsistent with small government Jeffersonianism. And we do that kind of thing over and over again in our history. The other great example, just very quickly, is Lincoln's greatest, most important political speech was probably the speech he gave at Cooper Union in New York City in 1860, which was in some ways the speech that won him the Republican nomination. And he was devoted to arguing that the founders actually agreed with him that ultimately slavery would be extinguished in the United States, even if some of those founders were slaveholders. So we do this a lot as Americans. And my book is very much is trying to describe that, and it's very much in this tradition.
You mentioned the conversation between the historian Eric Foner and a reporter. And she asks him, when's it going to be that historians stop relating just facts? When are they going to start just relating facts and stop revising the interpretations of the past? Or when was it, I guess, that was the case? And he said, around the time of
Thucydides.
Thucydides, sorry, yeah.
I mean, history is
we've always done it, I guess, the point, yeah.
Right. Well, also, history is about stating the facts accurately and trying to be true to the understanding that people had at the time they were acting. But putting together the facts, deciding how they fit together, deciding which facts are important, these are all part of a process of discernment. They're a process of interpretation. And you mentioned the historian Eric Foner. He's important in my account because of the he was the, probably the most important contemporary historian of Reconstruction.
Yeah.
And our view of Reconstruction after the Civil War has gone through massive revision, and as we interpreted it differently, that Reconstruction was initially conceived by African Americans in the South and the North as an effort to free the South from the costs of slavery, to create a more egalitarian society in the South. Then when the country turned, not to put too fine a point on it, more racist around the turn of the century, that view of Reconstruction went out the window, yeah. And we suddenly had a view that still in some ways sticks in people's heads, that the carpetbackers and the scallywags came down to the South and oppressed the Southern people and used Southern blacks to run corrupt regimes. Well, this just was a racist view that misinterpreted what happened. And it wasn't until the 1940s, 1950s, with, by the way, the rise of the Civil Rights Movement, that historians went back and said, wait a minute, African Americans were much more the authors of their own fate. They were the ones who demanded the right to vote. These Reconstruction governments did extraordinary things for the South, building a common school system, trying to create a more commercial and prosperous society. And so we go through interpretations of events in the past, and there is an inevitable influence of our contemporary politics on how we go about that process of interpretation.
You write about also how understanding this duality of the American character has been something of a national pastime, you say, since the time of Tocqueville. To talk about Tocqueville, if you would, because you say that he saw those two strains, individualism and this idea of the community, and he was even worried that at some point individualism was going to overtake that, I guess, that community impulse.
Right. Well, Tocqueville was the great French aristocrat who came to our shores trying to explain America to the French and to the rest of the world. And he was one of the most brilliant interpreters of the United States. And his book is two volumes, Democracy in America, is full of brilliant aphorisms about who we are. Tocqueville is somebody who conservatives and liberals alike like to cite, because conservatives place a heavy emphasis on how Tocqueville did see us as a striving commercial people. And he also laid heavy stress on the forms of local community and churches that conservatives are fond of. Progressives revere Tocqueville because he understood that in the absence of a strong sense of the common good and a strong sense of community, this whole experiment in self-government would be in great danger. Hmm. My favorite thing that Tocqueville observed about us is that whatever our flaws, Americans had a great capacity for self-correction. And my favorite line on us as Americans, I think, is from Winston Churchill, who was echoing Tocqueville when he said, "Americans always do the right thing after first exhausting all of the other possibilities." And I love that line because it doesn't assume that we are always right. It doesn't assume that we haven't made mistakes. It doesn't assume that there weren't evils in our history. Slavery was an evil. Yet it accepts the fact, it celebrates the fact that we Americans are pretty good at learning from error and eventually getting to the right place. We did it on slavery. We did it on civil rights. We did it on the right to vote for women and the equality of women. And that's why one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is to argue to my friends who are progressives and liberals that we really should embrace the American story as much as our friends in the Tea Party do, and we should have an argument with them about what American history actually means.
Mm. Tocqueville described the sense of community as habits of the heart. And it's the name of a book that you cite in your book, Robert Bella, who writes something that I wanted you to explore with us. And you sort of referenced Benjamin Franklin and Walt Whitman, and these are the kind of the two strains of individualism in this country. Explain that, if you would. Go through that with us.
Right. I should say Robert Bella is an absolutely brilliant interpreter of American life, and he was very important to this account. He was one of the first people I sent a copy of the book to when I finished, because he was so important to me. And he has this wonderful part of Habits of the Heart where he talks about our having the two strands of communitarianism, Republican and biblical, but also two strands of individualism. And one of them he ascribes to Franklin, as he writes, the archetypical poor boy who made good, and that Franklin emphasized what many felt in the 18th century and many have felt ever since to be the most important thing about America, the chance for the individual to get ahead on his own initiative. And he quotes Franklin as saying about Americans, if they are poor, they begin first as servants or journeymen. And if they are sober, industrious, and frugal, they soon become masters, establish themselves in business, marry, raise families, and become respectable citizens. And Bella calls this approach a utilitarian individualism. It's kind of striving individualism. Walt Whitman, on the other hand, was also an individualist, but he was what they call an expressive individualist. He believed that in a successful life, and again, I'm quoting Bella, a successful life was rich in experience, open to all kinds of people, luxuriating in the sensual as well as the intellectual, above all, a life of strong feeling. In some ways, after I read Bella, I came to think of the Franklin and Whitman as the capitalist and the hippie, and that when you think back to the 1960s, you know, there was the rise of a new conservative movement, groups like Young Americans for Freedom. And while I don't think you can limit Franklin to being a conservative, he was many things. I think it was that brand of individualism that they embraced. And then you had the New Left and the counterculture who really embraced Walt Whitman's form of individualism. And I should note here that my children go to a public school called Walt Whitman High School, which I got more and more of a kick out of as I was writing this particular book.
We'll come back to Whitman when we get to the sort of counterculture movement. Say something, if you would, though, about this biblical strand of communitarianism, which is really important in the way the country established the idea for itself. I mean, you trace it back to the Puritan settlements, for example, and that image of the city set upon a hill, John Winthrop.
Right. And many of your listeners will remember that one of Ronald Reagan's favorite phrases was in describing the United States was that we were a shining city on a hill. And that comes from a John Winthrop sermon given back in 1630 called A Model of Christian Charity. And it's really a wonderful sermon. We forget people talk about the Puritans as being, dour and primarily concerned with a narrow view of personal or sexual behavior. But the other side of Puritanism was a very robust sense of community and our obligations to each other. And in the book, I quote one of my favorite lines from this sermon where Winthrop says, we must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body. And I can't resist noting that Rush Limbaugh might regard Winthrop as some kind of socialist for saying those things. Since the book was published, I've enjoyed linking that great Puritan John Winthrop in 1630 to a figure we know well in 2012, Bruce Springsteen. I don't know if you have heard Springsteen's new album, but The very first song on that album is a song where the refrain is, wherever this flag is flown, meaning our flag, wherever this flag is flown, we take care of our own. And I like to trace a direct line between John Winthrop and 1630 and Bruce Springsteen in 2012 for reflecting this very strong sense of our obligation to each other that I think is one of the very best parts of what it means to be an American.
E.J. Dionne is with us. His book is Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the columnist E.J. Dionne is our guest. He's written a book that explores the questions of who we are as a country and what it is that seems to be tearing us apart. These days you hear the political battle described as a struggle between the public realm and the private, the individual and the community. But Dionne says there's always been that tension in American history, and in the best of times we found a balance between the two. His book is called Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You mentioned Henry Clay before, the great orator and senator and congressman. It's interesting, his take on kind of the American idea is interesting because he seemed to suggest that the real distinction, for example, between what he called the American system and the British system, for example, was that, as I understand it, E.J. Dionne, Americans didn't just let the market work without some kind of pushing or prodding, I guess. Is that right?
Right. You asked earlier what discoveries I made in this book. One of them is I'd always known from history in high school that Henry Clay had the American system, that's what he called his program. What I had not realized is that he called it the American system to distinguish it from British laissez-faire. And he was saying, and this goes quite against the grain right now, where we would say that if something in the world is called American in terms of an economic system, it's always the most market-oriented system. But Henry Clay said no, that in the United States, we believed as Americans that government had a role to play in building up the nation. Hamilton was one of perhaps the first strong advocate of federal help for building the roads and the canals and the other forms of infrastructure that tie the country together, except the Whigs back then had a much better word for infrastructure. They called it internal improvements. Mm-hmm. And I would love to have us abandon the word infrastructure and start talking about internal improvements again. He also believed the government had a major role in helping create us as a major manufacturing power, industrial power in the world. He shared that in common with Henry Clay. Daniel Walker Howe, a great American historian, said of Clay that of all the major figures in political history, Clay had the most systematic and multifaceted program. And if he had been able to implement it, and then Howe writes, that is, if he had been as capable a politician as he was an ideologist, he would have changed the course of American history in the 19th century and created more precedent for government intervention in the economy and a planned response to social problems. But that idea was there right from the beginning. And it's worth noting that Henry Clay was Abraham Lincoln's political hero. And Lincoln continued in the Clay tradition in many of his actions. I mean, he wanted to hold the Union together because he believed that that we were a nation and not simply a collection of states. Mm. He is the guy, Lincoln signed the bill creating land-grant colleges, which grew into our great state universities. And so this was a view not that began in the New Deal or with the Great Society, but way back at the beginning, in the early part and mid part of the 19th century, that said government is not the enemy of social progress. It's not the enemy of individual freedom, or at least it doesn't have to be.
You write about the intention of the country's earliest leaders was, in terms of the role of the government, was to sort of keep the community, in fact, connected. You write about some other government programs. The Civil War pensions, for example, were really interesting.
Right. And at one point in our history, I think it was 37% of the federal budget was in Civil War pensions. In many ways, Civil War pensions were a precursor to the Social Security system because, of course, it was such an all-encompassing war that so many Americans were eligible for Civil War pensions. And the program regularly got expanded. Voters like more programs to widows, to orphans of Civil War veterans. And so that is one precedent. The other precedent that, again, something I discovered writing the book, was the Federal Marine Hospital System. And if I had asked myself the question before I wrote this book, when was the first federal health care program passed, I would not have come up with what is the right answer, which is in 1798. 10 years after the adoption of the Constitution, Congress passed and President Adams signed the creation of a system of hospitals and hospital care for sick and injured sailors in the country. And I like to note that nowhere in the record can I find a mass demonstrations against Adams care. But we did have socialized medicine for seamen way back at the beginning of the Republic.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Andrew is with us in Overland Park, Kansas. Andrew, welcome.
I'm here. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Enjoying the conversation today.
Good.
Well, I just had a question for your guest today. I appreciate, even though it seems like we are on separate sides of the aisle, I would call myself very fiscally conservative. But I have a lot of liberal friends, and we have a lot of, you know, issues that we agree on, a lot of the stuff that we agree on. And with the divisive politics today, it's nice to hear somebody that, even though he's on the other side of the aisle, makes an effort to bring both sides together, it sounds like. But what my question came down to is how he feels. I don't think anybody could argue that Obama himself is very, very divisive, even though I would call myself a moderate in a lot of ways. I really, really adamantly disagree with how he seems to be dividing the country in so many ways. And I'd kind of like to hear his response on if he feels like that's happening and how that's pretty destructive. I feel like Americans today need somebody that can bring us together, and I know that's what he promised to do, but it seems to be the exact opposite of that. I've never seen Americans so divisive on everything these days, and I think a lot of his speeches contribute to that.
You know, it's interesting, E.J. Dionne, before you, I wanted to put Andrew's comment in the context of another speech, a particular speech given by Barack Obama. And it fits into the book in the section where you're talking about modern politicians like Bill Clinton, for example, like Barack Obama, who have been trying to, at least this is my impression of it, trying to kind of revive this idea of community. So Andrew's question is kind of ironic. In fact, I wanted to play a moment from a speech that you mention in the book. It's a speech that was given back in 2006. And it was call to renewal speech. Let me play a moment of it. This is a section that you actually quote. Where Barack Obama, in fact, is not trying to divide, but he's trying to, I guess, reconnect the idea of liberalism with the idea of community. Let's play this and we can talk about it. This is Barack Obama in 2006.
So our failure as progressives to tap into the moral underpinnings of the nation is not just rhetorical, though. Our fear of getting preachy may also lead us to discount the role that values and culture play in some of our most urgent social problems. After all, the problem of poverty and racism, the uninsured and the unemployed, all the problems that are chronicled in this pamphlet, are not simply technical problems in search of the perfect 10-point plan. They're rooted in both societal indifference and individual callousness. They're rooted in the imperfections of man. And solving these problems will require changes in government policy, but it will also require a change in hearts and a change in minds. I believe in keeping guns off the streets of the inner city, and that our leaders must say so in the face of the gun manufacturers' lobby. But I also believe that when a gangbanger shoots indiscriminately into a crowd because he feels somebody's disrespected him, we've got a moral problem. There's a hole in that young man's heart, and a hole that the government alone cannot fix.
thought there was a lot interesting in that speech. The reference to guns was particularly relevant, I guess, in light of what the conversation is going on right now. But talk about that, if you would, and then relate that to what Andrew's concern is, which is Andrew's not hearing a call to community from the president. He's hearing, and it sounds like, an evolved Barack Obama who's now, at least from his perspective, more divisive than ever, I guess.
Yeah, and I do want to thank Andrew for the kind comments he made at the beginning of his call. Everybody, even his critics, have a favorite Barack Obama speech. Some point to the 2004 convention speech. Some point to the Jeremiah Wright speech. This is my favorite Obama speech, partly because I think it's one of the best speeches by a politician talking about religion and the role of religion in American public life that we've heard in a very long time. And one of the reasons I like the speech is because it is very carefully balanced in terms of its critique of where liberals, and he identifies himself as a progressive, but where we progressives have gone off the rails in not appreciating the role of religion in our public life and in the importance of accepting that if people are religious, they will bring their religion to the public square and to the public argument. And that is entirely legitimate. That's different from using the state to impose religion on people, which we don't want government to do. But then he also takes conservatives to task for not accepting that not all Americans are people of faith and that we do want a very open public square, that if it is open to religious people, so too should it be open to non-religious people. And to there are non-religious people with superb values and very community-minded behavior, just as there are people like that on the religious side. I think on Andrew's question, I will probably sound like some of the Overland Park friends he has arguments with on Barack Obama, because I think Obama started out very much on the line that Andrew wanted him to start out on. And I think that if you we could debate this all day, and we'll be debating it for the next 4 months. You know, if you look at the stimulus program, he included a large chunk of that as tax cuts, as an overture to Republicans. It was accepted by three senators, not accepted at all. His health care plan, he spent months and months negotiating this, I think, took way too much time seeking Republican support that was never going to be there. He put forward a health care plan that was rooted in ideas from, yes, from Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, yes, from the Heritage Foundation, and yes, from Republicans in the 1990s. Obama's health care plan looks far more like the Republican alternative to Hillary Clinton's health care plan than it does like Clinton's plan from 1990. So I think he continually tried to reach some kind of consensus with Republicans. And again, I'm sure Andrew and I could have an argument about this. I think what's happened is that this is a very different Republican Party than the Republican Party that existed 5, 10, or 20 years ago. I think there were Republicans in the past who could have reached common ground with Obama. Now, you had a Republican who beat Senator Lugar in Indiana in the primary, who explicitly rejected the idea of compromise and said, and I'm paraphrasing, that you know, my view of compromise is when the other guy comes to my position. And so I think you are talking much more about a radicalization on the right. And from my point of view, I think President Obama was right to say, all right, this won't work. We have a big philosophical argument going on in the country, and I'm going to hold up my side of the argument, and the country is going to make a decision. I personally think Obama doesn't like conflict. I think he'd rather govern like Andrew would like him to govern. But the circumstances have not allowed it up to now.
Mm. You do make note of the fact that Democrats and liberals did have to or do have to answer for some forms of cultural liberation that were looked on with skepticism and hostility. You mentioned the counterculture in the 1960s, for example. And this seemed to be something that Barack Obama was trying to repair, I guess, and Bill Clinton was trying to repair in some ways as well. But you do have some criticism, of course, for the way liberals have handled their own past and their own ideology and their own underpinnings, I guess.
Right. Well, I mean, think about the phrase, if it feels good, do it, which is a classic kind of 60s phrase. Well, sometimes doing the thing that feels good is not only forget, even put aside whether in somebody's system of, say, sexual morality or morality toward drugs, put aside for a second the moral question in that respect. Think of the larger moral question of how does what I am about to do affect my community? How does it affect other people? How might it affect children around me? If it feels good, do it is not a good slogan. It's not a good slogan in personal behavior. By the way, it's not always a good slogan in economic behavior. There are legitimate and illegitimate ways to make money. There are legitimate and illegitimate ways to run the economy. And I think that liberals did get caught up in a certain style of individualism that both Clinton, ironically, some would say, in light of other aspects of his administration, and Barack Obama were critics of. And they said, wait a minute, liberals forgot about the community interests. They forgot the long history of liberal engagement with community, that speech that you played from Obama. They forgot about religion's role in building up the country. And so I think that both Clinton and Obama were trying to achieve a correction, if you will, within liberalism that, in fairness, a lot of other liberals wanted to make, too. One of the points I make, I quote the historian Alan Brinkley, noting that if you go back to the original New Deal, the community idea was very important to Roosevelt. He spoke about community in his first inaugural address and mutual responsibility more than he spoke about liberty or individualism. He didn't mention those at all in that speech. So I think there were inherent in liberalism communitarian tendencies that kind of reemerged in the 90s and the 2000s and with the rise of Barack Obama.
Andrew, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. E.J. Dionne is with us. His book is Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. And we need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with E.J. Dionne. We're talking about his book, Our Divided Political Heart. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So in the book, you talk about you get at this question of how a movement like conservatism, which you say was, you know, born in opposition to individualism, came to be what you call the unapologetic carrier of this really robust strain of individualism. And it makes me wonder, because you say that conservatism without this strong communal and compassionate side will be untrue to its intellectual roots. And it made me wonder whether or not this brand of conservatism today is in fact still at all connected to that, if it's not in some ways a new brand of conservatism, a new species almost in some way.
Well, let me just first, there's that old line that a liberal is someone who can't even take his own side in an argument. and I just want to sort of say what I think the conservative critique of what I say is, and then I want to answer it, which is conservatives would say, look, we still care about community. We belong to little leagues. We belong to churches. Yeah. We belong to voluntary groups. We belong to Rotary clubs. We do an awful lot for our community. We just don't like government. And we think you liberals, progressives, conflate government with community. And there is something to that critique, as we said earlier, although I think their mistake is in viewing government in a free country as utterly disconnected from the community or having any role in building up the community. But I think that this new form of individualism has gotten so extreme that it is skeptical of all kinds of collective or communal action. And it doesn't emphasize the idea as the philosopher Michael Sandel put it, that when democracy goes well, we can know a good in common that we cannot know alone. And I think historically conservatives always saw the idea that society could be bigger than its component parts in the richness it can convey to our lives. And if you go back and look at the history of both conservatism and the Republican Party, you see people who understood that there was both a role for government in solving social problems and in regulating concentrated economic power, and believed in this communal view. It was Abraham Lincoln, whom Barack Obama quotes all the time, who said that we turn to government to do the things that we cannot do for ourselves. That does not strike me as a radical view. That strikes me as a quite conservative view. And so to go where you started, I think, yes, this new conservatism is in danger of being something not at all conservative, but quite radical in its understanding of who human beings are, how we behave, and what our relation is to both society and government. And I'm hoping I can start a bit of an argument with my conservative friends. Actually, right before I did your show, I was on a conservative talk show to argue with a conservative about this, because I would, even if I'm a liberal and conservatives may not listen to me, I'd like to try to call conservatives back to thinking about what they had been and what they may be losing in their current move toward a more radical form of individualism.
And you do mention, by the way, as well, you say to liberals that, this is not the time to be ambivalent about the ideas of community and populism, you know, these ideas about flyover country and Jesus land. You said that there needs to be more of an acknowledgement by liberals that there is wisdom in small towns and rural places. That's a point you make in the book.
Well, yeah. In fact, I grew up on the East Coast, but I have always hated that term, flyover country or Jesus land. I have always upbraided people who use it. And if you're a progressive, where was progressive strongest? Well, it was strongest in the middle of the country, progressivism and populism. It was strong in places like Minnesota and like Wisconsin and like Kansas and in the Rocky Mountain states. And so for this kind of elitism, I think, is antithetical to what a progressive ought to be. And it's also a pure form of bigotry. And we liberals and progressives are supposed to be against bigotry and ought to stand against it in all its forms. But the other thing in terms of being robust in defending a certain set of ideas, I wrote this book in part because I think liberals had been intimidated into refusing to say what they really believe about government. We really believe that government has accomplished great things in American life. We don't want it to be all powerful, but we do think it solves problems. We do think it can prevent radical forms of inequality, which I think are antithetical to democracy. So we ought to go out there and say we believe this and not just pretend we don't really believe in government. But the other side of it, and I get to this at the end of the book, is that I think progressives also need to be very committed publicly and in their actions to reforming government. I think no one has more of an interest in government reform than progressives do, because we say outright that we believe government can do good things. So if we believe that, we've got to persuade people that government can work effectively. And while President Obama has actually done some things to reform government, particularly in the case of FEMA and other parts of the government, I do not think he's made that as central a purpose of his administration as he should, as I think all progressive politicians should.
We don't have time for Dan in Orem has a question. And Dan, if you'll forgive me, I'm going to paraphrase your question because it goes to something that I wanted to ask. He's referencing the sense of individualism and community within the early Mormon community, which to my mind anyway brings up Mitt Romney because of his Mormon past. And you don't write about this in the book, but I'm wondering if you wonder whether he expresses them or not, that he doesn't have a sense of community based on just, you know, that idea that's deeply embedded in his family, deeply embedded in his church.
Well, this is not a view original to me. I mean, a lot of people have been saying this. I think that Romney's fear of anti-Mormon prejudice, his desire not to have his faith get in the way of his election has made him far less forthcoming about something that is clearly very, very, very important in his life. I think his faith, from all we do know about him, is one of the most important aspects of his life. And I think in general, he hasn't done a very good job of presenting a biography of himself to voters that voters would find attractive. He hasn't spent very – he's really done very little positive advertising. And I don't deny that there is something to his political calculation here and that there are dangers in doing this. But I do think he'd be better off if he could find a way of talking about this more and describing the relationship of this to his faith. I wrote once about Senator Hatch out there in Utah and how he and Ted Kennedy came to co-sponsorship of a very substantial expansion of the of AmeriCorps, of the community service program. And it was one of the last political acts of Ted Kennedy's life, and it was in alliance with his friend Orrin Hatch. And Hatch spoke openly about how his Mormonism influenced his view of service to the community. And I think that's something that Romney would do well to talk about. I'm not in the business of, given where my politics lie, I'm not in the business of giving him political advice, but I would like to hear more about it, and I do think it would be useful.
Let me ask you this finally. You mentioned in the book that the long consensus you talk about, where that time where we did seem to agree on some of these things, cannot be restored in the same form that it took in the 20th century. And it seems you put a lot of hope in the younger generation that they have a decent sense of that balance.
I do. I joked with some students of mine that the younger generation was the deus ex machina of my book, The Magical Way in Which All of This Will Come to Pass. But it's very striking if you look at all – there have been a lot of studies of the millennial generation, and it strikes me that they get both sides of us as Americans better than their elders do. On the one hand, they clearly have very strong individualistic instincts. They were pioneers with the new technology. They know how this technology empowers individuals. They are remarkably free of prejudice compared to other generations. And yet you look at what they did with the new technology. They quickly used it to form social networks. They are the most service-oriented generation to come in along in a long time. And so I am really counting on them to bring back a long consensus that could pull us all together again.
E.J. Dionne, his book is Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. He joined us from Washington, D.C. E.J., thanks very much for the time.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Matthew Martin and Tim Slover are our interns. The program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.